That clock back there is wrong. We'll start on my time and quit with that one. I am pleased to start my time with you on my favorite subject. I have spent most of my life with animals, and it probably shows. The particular subject that I will be addressing tonight has consumed a significant part of the last 10 years, and it will also be the subject of most of the days I have left on earth. And I use a lot of t-shirts and buttons for props. This is pets. Pets are wonderful. It wasn't color coordinated, so I didn't wear it. I have a button for it, though. I also have a, my wife has a sweatshirt. I have two. It's called People Keep Pets Healthy and Happy. Pets Keep People Healthy and Happy. Here's my pause one. Pets are wonderful. And just for old time's sake, I often wear, my Hollands are beautiful. I didn't want to pin them on my shirt because this is my favorite shirt and it's getting pretty old. But I still like it. I'm going to let go a few bluebirds tonight. These are Western bluebirds for those of you who are not experienced bird watchers. Since I don't read very well, we're going to have slides. If I can find my way back here, I'm now turning off the lights so you can start sleeping. I'll let you know when you wake up. Maybe you can give me just a little bit of light up there. Yeah, that's pretty good. I got a good prop man up there. This is a self-portrait, so that those of you who sit in the back and don't want to talk to me sometime while I'm here, that you'll recognize me walking in the village. It's really a self-portrait I did of myself when I was a dean. I was a principal administrative officer. You can always tell a principal administrative officer by his silhouette. The sloping shoulders and the sloping forehead for all the times that you've said, I don't know, and why didn't I think of that before? There are many revolutions underway that do affect me in my business, and I will dwell principally on one of them, but I want to mention another, and that is how the computer age is taking us over, and that's why the human-animal bond is going to be so important, and I'll discuss this more later in my time with you, but we worship the computer as if it's God. I have been working on computers in biomedical research since 1950. That's almost before the Norwegians invented the computer. It would certainly be a lot easier, Mrs. Letts, if you would pay us the $8,240 bill for spaying your cat than for us to find the error in our computer. We still got problems. First, I'm going to talk. I'm really hitting the human-animal bond from the standpoint of research, service, and teaching. And I'm going to start in with just a few on research to show you the great significance of this to a research worker. And a lot of research workers haven't figured this out yet. Incidentally, I first, well, this doesn't back up, huh? Does it? I'm pressing back, and it's backing. Ah. It's temperamental. Must be female, right? Well, I'm glad to hear you're still awake. I first became aware of this early in my life with the pigs, when I tried to raise baby pigs without their mother. And it was a disaster. After I'd had them for a while, I tried to give them back to the mother, the sow, and the piglets preferred me. It does attract attractive pig herders, however. I read some work early in my business because I was doing work on the thyroid. And this was work that was started the year I was born, which was 1920. A fellow named Hammett at the Worcester was very interested in determining at that time what the thyroid and the parathyroid did. In the old days, we tried to figure out what various glands did by extirpating them. That is, slight cutting them out. And so he was going to define this, so he says, bring me some rats, and we'll cut out the thyroids and the parathyroids, and we'll find out what happens to them. He expected most of them to die. They brought him two sets of rats. In one group, he only had 13% mortality. In the other group, 79%. He said, where'd you get these rats? And they said, well, one group, we've been gentling them for five generations. We go down and pet them and talk to them every day. And that's the gentle group with only 13% mortality. The other group, all we did was feed and water them. And you don't have to do a t-test or advanced statistics to determine that this is a significant difference. Now, some time ago, there was a report in Science, and they had rabbits, and they divided the rabbit groups into generally two groups, and they had various diets. Some of them were atherosclerotic producing diet. And they found out that there was a very significant difference in the rabbits, in the main two groups, whether you gentled them or not. If you gentled them, there was less atherosclerotic lesion. There has also been other work. For example, one that's very startling to a lot of people, that is, they gentled baby mice for their first 21 days of their life, and there was a significant difference in their resistance to disease in favor of those that had been gentled. The same with chickens. A lot of you don't give too much credit to chickens. They usually refer to them as bird brain or something, or I guess that's people, maybe. But anyway, it's to signify a sort of an IQ below detection. But in this case, they gentled these chickens and found out they were far more resistant to disease. They had better feed utilization, better gain, and essentially most of the parameters they were measuring. And this was significant. The last one is one I ran across from Australia, down at Werribee. This fellow named Hemsworth was very concerned about the differences one saw in raising swine, the difference in productivity, weight gain, conception rate, and so forth. So what he did was very simple. He divided these 11-week-old pigs into two groups. And in one group, just three times a week, for only a very few minutes, he'd go in, and when the pigs came to him in the A group, he would talk nice to them and pet them. In the other group, he walked into them, same kind of pigs, only when they came to him, he'd slap them or give them a slight shock. And these are the results. The growth was better in those that had a pleasant experience. The feed conversion, which is spelled incorrectly, it was better. The first mating, in other words, sexual maturity, occurred 30 days earlier in the gentle group. And also the first heat appeared. And then the startling thing about it to most everybody that I've told this to is that they bred them on the second heat period, and the conception rate was 87% in the gentle group and only 33% in those that had this just a few minutes each day up until 22 weeks. This is very striking to a lot of people. You see, in laboratory animal science, where I've spent a good deal of my life, I've been harping on one thing for many years. We have gone a long ways in producing a better experimental animal, a better nutrition, better housing, but we haven't dealt with the most important factor, and that's the human factor. This can make a lot of difference, and I could give you a half hour on that, but you're not ready for that tonight. Now, I'm going to talk. We live in a time in which even rabbits are portrayed as being smarter than people on television. We live in an animal-oriented society. I remember now we decided last fall we couldn't afford both a distemper shot for the dog and a flu shot for you. I have known in many cases where the family had limited resources, and if the mother-in-law was sick and the dog was sick, I can tell you who got the medical attention. Sometimes even with the kids, you know, well, same thing the kid had 6 weeks ago. But if the dog gets sick, it's off to the veterinary. I'm not justifying that. It's just a fact of life. I could also give you quite a dissertation on this. Now I'm going to talk about this human-animal bond within the family structure. And this is my wife, who I call the chief. When we were at the University of California, she complained a lot because I was gone so much. So I says, "Well, we got this dog. It's on the right there, that pretty little terrier." She wondered what we should call it, and I said, "Well, we'll call it Great Reluctance, so that whenever I leave you, I can leave you with Great Reluctance." Now it's kind of different. I sort of identify with Hagar the Horrible. I don't know if you know this slovenly old Norwegian portrayed in the newspapers. He's usually out plundering somewhere, or he's home deep in suds. And this was such an occasion when he was deep in suds, and his wife was talking to the neighbor lady. And the neighbor lady says to Helga, who's Hagar's wife, "Did you really realize that before you married Hagar, that he'd be gone a lot?" "No," she said, "I just lucked out." So that tells you a little bit about the chief. My wife probably appropriately drives a white rabbit, and that's the truth. And she's driving this white rabbit here, and the caption on this thing is, "Although Great Reluctance is 16 years old, he still loves to chase cars." But in our existence today, We fail to realize that we have what I call the eternal triangle. To the extent that we are successful in our situation, I think is dependent a great deal on how we relate to our environment, the plants and the animals. And to the extent that we are separated from them, and especially as I'm discussing tonight, separated from animals, we are the poorer for it. And that's the case that I'm going to make tonight. And it is no accident that the Delta Society, of which I am president, which is devoted to investigation and collecting material on the human-animal bond, that it is also a triangle. Now, the human-animal bond is something that's gone on for a very long time. Many, many hundreds of years ago, the doctors would often prescribe animals for people. Lap dogs for women with abdominal problems. If you were going crazy, they'd issue a dog to carry around.
We know now that has physiological and psychological bases. And here the caption on this, I don't have the one with me. It's in French, and it says, "The tongue of the dog is medicine." For centuries, they thought that. In fact, today you could go to Turkestan, and in the pediatric ward, they have dogs there that sort of clean up from what comes out of both ends of their patients. And that's the truth. To go back, how long has this been going on? It's very well defined archaeologically, both in Iraq and in Israel, that this close association goes back at least 13,000 years. There was a report in National Geographic by a leading anthropologist a few years ago, and from diggings in the Old Crow region in the Yukon, that this might go back 28,000 years. This was done by radioactive dating. This, of course, caused a lot of people to scratch their heads. When I was in Australia teaching this last year at Murdoch University, some of those people claim, well, it's probably gone on for 50,000 years, but we don't have evidence for this. But whatever it is, it's gone on for a very long time. And of course, the animals have come into the religions, into many religions. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, the lamb and the dove, for example, are very much into it. The god Zeus is a bull. And with the Indian culture, where the line between human and animal is not as fine, the coyote and the salmon are very important to them. And here is a mummified cat. The Egyptians were really keen about cats many years ago. In fact, they were so keen about them that if you killed a cat, it was probably worth your life. And if the cat died, you shaved your eyebrows and I guess sometimes your head for I suppose, and went into mourning for an extended period of time. So they were gung-ho on cats, and they mummified them with the best techniques of that period. In fact, not long ago, the English dug up some of these cats, about 85,000 of them, in fact, and they found out that not only was the mummified cat in there, but each one had been provided with a mouse. And what happened? I want to tell you a little more about the cats in Egypt. A Persian king was going to invade Egypt, and he was doing quite well, but he came to this large city, and he was unable to conquer it. He was having trouble, but he found out they were gung-ho on cats. They were gone on cats, so what he did was had his people collect up a whole bunch of cats, and he catapulted them into the city, and the city gave up. They couldn't see this happen to the cats. This is an interesting thing on this relationship. This is a honey guide and a ratel. And the ratel is built for digging out honeycomb out of honey trees because the bees aren't able to sting him and penetrate what he wears. He also has good claws for digging out honey trees. And he likes honey. And the honey guide is a bird about the size of a starling, but much prettier. And it likes the bee larvae. So when it finds a honey tree, it goes into a fluttering pattern of a certain type, which is recognized by this animal that then finds the honey tree, digs it out, and then they both share in the spoil. And of course, the Africans have also caught on to this, and they look for honey guides so they can follow the honey guide to the tree too. He probably, I don't know if he ends up with as much honey that way, or larvae, but that's a long association. Another very interesting one to me was the dolphin and the fisherman. This was described by Pliny the Elder a couple of thousand years ago, I suppose. But it wasn't believed at that time, but on the Mauritanian coast, it was well documented, I suppose, about 400 or 500 years ago, how the fishermen would set their nets, and then they would look out for shoals of mullet appearing, and then they would splash the water in a certain way, which would be the signal to the dolphins, who would move in abreast, often up to 10 abreast. They would move the fish into the nets and then they would both share in the take. Now, for a brief review on how animals have been used in therapy. I won't go into the Giel situation, but they have utilized animals there, I suppose, since maybe 1000 A.D., maybe even earlier than that. This has been written up rather well. The one that's usually given credit are the Tuke brothers' York retreat, which was started in 1792. At that time, and also even today, the treatment for the mentally handicapped people is very bad indeed. And they would lock them up for aberrant behavior. They wouldn't feed them very much, or they'd put them in chains. And it was a very terrible situation. The Tuke brothers, who were Quaker merchants, said that's no way to go. So by subscription, they set up the York retreat and would have then the people come in there. They would dress them up for tea. They had an educational program. They would not put them in chains for aberrant behavior, which they had no control. But very important to me was that they involved animals in the therapy. These people took care of rabbits, chickens, and other animals, and it was highly successful. In fact, it was probably the predecessor to much of that utilization in other places over up until quite recent times. And one of the most impressive places to me, I guess the most impressive place where I caught on to it first when I read Bright Valley of Love by a dear friend of many of us, Edna Hong, on her description of Bethel or Bethel, which means City of God, in Bielefeld, West Germany. It's a fantastic story, and she describes how animals were utilized there, and that's why I went to visit that place. And if you ever get the chance, I recommend it. It is the most remarkable place that I've ever visited. And the director, many years ago, we had sort of one thing, sort of a commonality between us, because he was a prisoner of war in this country when I was a prisoner of war in Germany, and he had the best deal. He admitted that. It was started in 1867, and they have utilized animals in their many situations there on their farms, and there are now over 5,000 people who are disadvantaged, and over 5,000 who take care of them in some of the most remarkable facilities that you or I will ever see. And they have a waterfowl. Here's some of the patients that I've visited there out in the farms. They also have a riding academy, a wild game park, an aviary, and dogs and cats. And it's truly a fantastic place. In my parents' native Norway, a place called Beitostølen up on the Valdres north of Oslo. You've probably heard of it mainly because they teach blind people how to ski there, and it's probably appropriate that they do since the director of it, Erling Stordal, and his wife Anna. Erling is a blind musician, and he has been responsible for setting up the sports plots. And animals are very important. They do a lot of physical therapy, and our family visited there. I wanted our daughter Becky to see this because she's in special education, and the remarkable facilities they had. And it was a day I'll never forget. They used dogs and horses a good deal there. They were also so successful in collecting up a lot of money, so they bought a place near the Twin Cities in Minnesota to start such a place. And I told them they couldn't have picked a better place because there's a lot of Swedes there, and wherever you have a lot of Swedes, you have a lot of disadvantaged people. You're still awake, yes. This is the late Boris Levinson. He's on the left, your left. The better looking of the two is Jingles, his dog. And he was a clinical psychologist, Yeshiva University. And many years ago, he always had a dog, but he'd always put it in the back room whenever he was expecting some referral patients. On this particular day, he had the dog with him because he wasn't expecting his next patient, a referral patient, for an hour and a half or so. Suddenly, the door opened up, and here's his patient. And the lady and her son. And if you'd had this kid, you'd have probably come early, too. Well, the dog went right for the boy, and she was, I suppose, filling out the forms and all. And suddenly she discovered that her son was mixing up with the dog. She was about to intervene. And old Boris says, no, let him go at it. And it was really then the key to his much of his future life. He wrote a lot of articles, a couple of books on this subject. And in fact, he dedicated one of them to Jingles, his dog. But a lot of people made fun of him. They said, they'd ask him at conferences, you know, do you share your fee with the dog and stuff like that. However, when we formed the Delta Society, he was the first recipient of the Delta Society's special award. And we were glad we did that because he just died here about a month or so ago. A great guy and a sort of a fellow that's sort of ahead of his time. And he recognized the importance of this for many disturbed people. He called for a structured study of this because much of his work was anecdotal, as much of this information is. Can you folks see this all right? I didn't ask you before. You see it all right. And if you can't hear me and you want to, you just let me know. I can raise the decibels. Some of the people that read his material became very interested in this, and two of them were Elizabeth and Sam Corson. They were working on a hyperkinetic model in dogs for hyperkinetic children at a psychiatric hospital at Ohio State University, and going about their work in a very educated way. And they were contacted by some of the patients there, and they said, we hear dogs barking, why can't we have access to the dogs? And they at first as well, you know, they were very busy. Then they got to thinking, oh, you know, we got these well-defined dogs. And so they went to the psychiatrist and they said, you know, we would like to try out this on some of your patients. So, of course, the psychiatrist, what patients did they give them? The ones that had been essentially refractive to any kind of therapy. I mean, they were the big losers, you see. Well, they were successful. I don't know whether they got 30 or 40 or 50 of them, but they felt they only had about one failure in this whole thing. I'll only tell you about one of them. And they kind of matched the dog to the patient. One of the patients was Sonny, who was 19 years old, sacked out, therapy hadn't worked for him at all. He wasn't communicating with anybody. So they brought him Arwin, who is a wire-haired terrier. And wire-haired terriers are like some of you. They're aggressive lovers. And they started mixing it up there and having a good time. And then Arwin jumped off the bed and went running down the hall, or the aisle in this ward. And old Sonny jumped out of bed and chased after him. First time he'd been out of his sack for weeks. And in 5 weeks, he checked out. The only time he came back, he'd come back to visit the dog. Well, unfortunately, the Corsons ran out of money. So they advertised these very well-defined dogs. And there's a fellow down at Millersburg, Ohio, at Castle Nursing Home. And he noted how, as he took his dog around to the Castle Nursing Home, how the people there really related to his dog. And he thought, boy, those dogs are for us. So he built a kennel, and old Corson shipped his dogs down there. I'll only tell you about one of the patients there, although it was highly successful. And this patient was Jed. And it's to make the point that a lot of aphasics can be helped by this, as well as autistics. This is Jed. Jed was now about 80 years old. He'd been there for a couple of decades. And as far as most people knew, he was essentially uncommunicative. Now and then he'd say a word or two at the most, or he'd grunt. So Corson brought him this dog, Sam did, and old Jed said, yeah, I brought that dog. So you could understand him, probably the most words he'd said in 20 years. And he asked if he could keep the dog, and certainly he could, so he was happy for his remaining years. The tragedy of it, of course, it didn't bring him sooner. But he started tracing pictures of dogs, and then freehand drawings of dogs, and I'll show you one of these. It's not a Rembrandt, but it's it has a very significant feature to it, which we'll discuss at other times too. But you see, they're both smiling. And it reminds me of some work that the vice president of Delta Society did, and that's Michael McCulloch, who's with Northwest Associates. He's very active in psychiatry in Portland. He also has an appointment with the medical school and also with the veterinary school at Corvallis, and a dear friend of mine. I think I have him, however, on as much as he has me on the couch, but. He had a long survey that he tried on a lot of people, what animals did for them. It's a very long survey. I'll only show you four questions here. But the only thing that was 100% was that it made me laugh and maintain my sense of humor, which is probably the best therapy today. And here's a picture of Mike. And he has other children. In fact, he always believed that you should get pets for your kids. Recently, he's gotten a kid for his pets. That's little Molly there. Now, another thing that moved me to do something about this was that I suppose on an average we kill about 13 to 15 million dogs and cats in the animal control centers in the United States. Now, that doesn't include all the ones that just haul them out in the country and let them go. I mean, you're talking a lot of blood in the floor. Huh? The animals are now being treated as throwaway items, and you say, well, these are mainly strays. Well, 80% of them were owned by people in one survey. This is a very condemning trait of our civilization, of our society. There's overpopulation of these animals, and the Industrial Revolution really changed the human-animal bond in many ways. In some cases, it made it almost abnormal. And in many cases, of course, it completely, you had a fracture of the bond because there was hardly any contact by many people to animals. And people don't really manage their animals well. I suppose far over 50% of the animal owners in this country are irresponsible animal owners. And I don't blame, for that reason, a lot of people who own rental property. No pets, no pets, no pets. Because they have people in there, have had people in there with pets. They deposit used dog food all over the place. They eat up the rugs, tear up the furniture in the kitchen, run through the screen door without opening it, bite the neighbor kids, sometimes for a good reason, and chase the mailman. And wake up everybody at 2 in the morning. That isn't somebody you like to rent to. So you can't blame them for that, I guess. And they don't bring them up right. Here's man's best friend, and they can't even hit the fire plug. And then we have this very sobering thing so many places. The animals are not treated very well at all. They're beaten, they're starved. And that's also bad for us. And I noticed, as here is a picture of a great reluctance, out visiting. We started this many years ago, my wife and I. And the people didn't want us there. They said, well, people will trip over it. So we carried him in. They didn't like that either. But then some women bought the convalescent home, and things changed. But we may address loneliness in association with some other lectures, but probably one of the worst diseases today is not cancer or heart disease, but it's probably loneliness, a devastating thing. And I have visited, well, I visit nursing homes a lot now because that's where most of my old girlfriends are, convalescent homes. But I've done it for many decades. And one of the very sobering things that I've found there was that in some of the people that I'd visit, nobody ever came to see them. And in talking to some of them, they were living sometimes independently well in their own homes. They had animals, the only thing that lived with them. And some well-meaning person says, oh, we'll get you down to a nice home for you. we'll take care of your animals, kill the animals, and run them off to some sterile nursing home or convalescent home. And there they sap, as this lady is, bare walls, waiting to die. Nobody needs her. Taken away from her at that point in her life, the only thing that gave her unconditional love, socialized her. If it was a dog, it made her walk around. Something to touch, which is very important. Something to laugh at, organize your life, and gives you security. You can't get that in a pill today. And that's what we've done to them. And if you'd find the same thing as I have if you had visited as many of them as I have. And it's a great tragedy. Now, that's why we're going in trying to get legislation changed on this and a lot of other things. And that's why we started the People Pet Partnership of Pullman and the Palouse. We call it the People Pet Partnership because nobody can handle the rest of it. Linda Hines and I did that many years ago. And that's what I'm going to tell you about now. And it's appropriate that I show this elderly lady with his dog. If you would have gone in and visited this lady, she probably wouldn't have given you the time of day. But if you'd have brought a dog with you, you better sit down because she's going to tell you all about it. What this does, what animals to a lot of people, probably over half the population, because over half the population have pets now, and in the agrarian population before this, even more probably had association, especially in our area, because it's an agrarian, it's a farming area. But the reminiscence is, to the extent that you reminisce, you are more healthy mentally. This is, in fact, one of the studies came out of Harvard on this back in 1962. But it stimulates reminiscence, which is very good. In fact, they use things to stimulate reminiscence now in therapy and among the elderly. And I'm trying to get them to use animals more than just things. All right, the first part of this program is called the elementary school program. We used to call it the public-private school partnership program, where our students, I want our students to learn how to deal with children and to take animals into the school system, because we have analyzed many elementary school systems, curricula, and there's very little introduction of kids to animals, the responsibility for animals, what they can do for you and what things you can't do to them. And we're a blank in many places on this. And that's why we got what we got, irresponsible animal owners. I took a chapter out of the Catholic Church in this. Get them when you're young and you got them. Or Kellogg's Corn Flakes. You get them on the cartoons on Saturday morning. So we go into the school system, and it's an exciting program. In fact, we do evaluations on them, and it's rated the highest of any program in our public school system. We're packaging it now, and you see the breakdown of it. We start them at preschool. I'd really like to start it in utero, but that's the best we can do now. In fact, in Australia, when I was down there 3.5 years ago now, in 2000, school system has bought into a program there for the 8 to 11-year-olds. It's a very successful program. And it's cost-benefit positive here, because using one dog like this, you can put about 5 kids on one dog. And this touch is very important to them. Our companion animal partnership program is another feature of this. Going into nursing homes, either having some staff member bring their own animal in on shift, or visiting. More and more, I try to encourage our students to bring an animal in and to learn to know an old person as a person. So you do it on a regular basis. In many places, we have recommended the mascot animal or animals. We made a very intensive study in one of the best nursing and convalescent homes and retirement homes in the Northwest, is Tacoma Lutheran Home. Our associates did about a 2.5-day study there, an evaluation. And some of you who are interested in this, we've developed guidelines, and I have a package of slides that we can look over on this if there is any interest in this. But they have several resident animals there now. I'll give you a couple of examples of what this does to a person. This is Marie. And in the convalescent home that I told you about earlier, we suggested that they set up a therapy room with a cat in it, Handsome the cat. And then they would vote on who should be brought into that room for therapy. They all voted for Marie. Marie had had a stroke, wasn't communicating with anybody. She was laying in a fetal position. And so they said, well, we'll bring Marie in there because she had a history of having cats. Now, she had another problem. She had sores on her legs which wouldn't heal, no matter what they'd tried. Well, if you know cats, if you start scratching, they think you're playing. And they'll grab your hand. Well, in 5 weeks, she was all healed up. You and I could have written prescription from here to Kingdom Come, and it probably wouldn't have done anything. But the cat sort of took care of that. She also, people would come in to see the cat, and she started socializing. And in fact, if you had been watching TV on PM Magazine out of Spokane about a year ago, you would have seen Marie on it, and she looked more like this. You wouldn't have known it was the same woman. A remarkable achievement. And the point I want to make here, one of the things that has moved me in this as a veterinarian is that it's very important that I protect the animal. It isn't fair to put an animal with a flaky person and end up with a flaky animal. You got to get the right kind of animal can withstand this, you see. And in some cases, you wouldn't place one. And in this makes the point here because we have, sure. An emergency.
We're having difficulty finding a member of the community. A fellow by the name of Adrian Mattson. It's a tall fellow, blonde, wears his hair down like this, and is last seen this afternoon wearing blue jeans and a light blue, light denim shirt. Since we have so many people gathered, we don't want to upset you, but we thought it would be worth it to ask if anybody had seen him at any time during the day, that we would be able to get another clue on him. How about it? Could I talk to you over here? Okay. Anyone else? Okay. You can have your prayers for him while you're listening to Leo. Thanks, Leo.
Sure. And then if you find out anything before we finish, maybe you'd let us know. And coming back to Marie, we have a good friend of ours named Elnor. And she has a dog named Daisy. And Daisy is this small dog pictured here. And she carries around the basket. So we call it Daisy the basket case. And she visits a lot of old people in their home and in nursing homes. But she also comes and visits this cat because this dog and the cat are very good friends. So that's... She also visits the cat, you see, so we don't forget the animals. This is another interesting case. One day we got a call from the convalescent home, and they said that we have a prescription here for Walter. A physician has written a prescription for Walter to get a dog. He says it's the only thing he knows that'll help Walter. Walter had given up on life. He had he just wanted to die. He didn't even want to see his grandchildren. And so he says, get him a dog. So we looked a long time. We finally got this dog out of Spokane Animal Control Center. His name is Boof, a real neat dog. And it had to be the right size because Walter was bound to his bed. And they're very cooperative at this nursing home. We cut a hole in the wall and had to run outside so he could go in and outside. This brings up a point. One of the many things I'm going to do when I get to be dictator is to plan buildings, not only for, well, they plan them for you now that you can walk in and out of places. Huh? Only recently they've been doing it for handicapped people. They haven't done anything about animals yet. And when I get to be dictator, they're also going to plan them for animals. As we are doing here. One of the things we have introduced in a few situations with terminally ill is to give them a cat, a very carefully selected cat, so they won't die alone. Probably one of the worst things you can do is to die alone. I got this idea from an acquaintance of mine named Cicely Saunders, Dame Cicely Saunders, who I'll probably mention tomorrow, one of the great people of the world. And she was the sort of the, well, she set out probably the model hospice in the world in St. Christopher's in London, and was knighted for her work, and also won a large award for this. But she has resident animals there, and also have visiting privileges for her patients. Prison partnership is very exciting to me, since I served time myself as a prisoner of war, and there it is. And this is my friend Kathy Quinn. Kathy is has been incarcerated 35 times in 14 different institutions, starting at the age of 13. She's still psychologically traumatized as a result of this. We've been trying to help her out. She can do anything with a dog. In fact, dogs are what saved her life. And she's also a good photographer. We talked a lot about how we could help prisoners with animals. We talked about a halfway house or getting into the state prisons. And one day she came up with the idea, why don't we take trainers into the Purdy prison, which is a maximum security prison in Western Washington, Gig Harbor, and that's what we did. We had expert trainers. It's part of the community college system there now. We ran a run through and we got enough publicity, and they were so pleased with what they saw. Somebody gave us enough money to build a kennel, and Kathy found the first recipient. She was contacted one day by Bert Push, who's in charge of the Independent Living Center in Puyallup. Now, Bert isn't built like you and me. He has only one digit on this hand. He has one big digit and two small digits on this hand. He's a little short guy. Introduced out at the prison to Sue, and that's Sue. And Sue knew what she had to train for, so we had an expert trainer, expert training out there, and she trained Glory. And I was there when Glory was transferred to Bert, and Sue choked up. Now, if you know prisoners, contract killers usually don't choke up. Sue is a contract killer. She's a lifer. And it's changed Sue a very great deal. As it's changed a lot of other prisoners, or I'd be out of that prison tomorrow if something wasn't good happening. They're learning something. And now Sue, we always gave a wide berth to, is now in charge of the dog kennel there that we got as a gift. And she spends 4 to 6 hours a day on it. And those dogs all clue you in and get tender, loving care. And when I was on an inspection tour there recently, you could have eaten off the floor of this kennel. So this has been a remarkable thing. Now, I watched this dog perform. And you can call Glory over. She came running in with a pack on her back. You say, Glory, stay. And boy, it takes quite a bit to move her so he can crawl up on her. And if you throw a dime down, the dog will fetch and she'll get the money and bring it right back to you. She can usually answer the phone, get the phone to him by the second ring, even if it's behind the sliding door. He has trouble with sliding doors, but she can open sliding doors. And, he, and she's a great companion to him, which is also one of the requirements that he asked for. So there probably wasn't a dry in the crown. Here's prisoners and some of the trainers. In fact, in the Delta Society, I've just appointed an international working group with some of the leading people in Australia, this country, and also England. In fact, a member of parliament in England, Janet Fuchs, Dame Phyllis Frost from Australia. She's one of the outstanding correction people in the world and a fantastic person. And we're exchanging information now on animals in prison. I don't know if you know much about prison systems, but most of what we're doing isn't working. And we feel that this may have a show. We've also worked in the Lorton prison, in where they have animals now in Washington, D.C. And of course, Lima State Prison, Ohio, is famous for this. Dave Lee has done remarkable work there. Partnership in Equine Therapy and Education is another part of our program, where we ride for the handicapped people, physical and mental. And if you've been in a wheelchair all your life, looking up, and you're suddenly vaulted onto a horse looking down, going places you've never been, it's really remarkable. And it also has a therapeutic effect, the fact of riding. The Germans, Europeans, Scandinavians have done a lot more on this than we have. But I have to move on here. I could spend an hour just on that subject. There's an older fellow, probably the best week of his life. He's over 70, a mentally retarded person. Best week of his life was probably at summer camp with the horses. Animal selection is very important in this. For the failures that I've seen in this, you can usually trace it to poor selection and management of it. And Dory, a famous Palouse dog, is fired. There's a case where somebody heard about this and they said, we'll run down to the animal control center, pick out a pretty little dog and take it out to him and dump it on the doorstep. And now your troubles are over. Now your troubles are just starting. And that's what happened here. They didn't consult us and nobody was really in charge of this. The dog was biting the kids, depositing used dog food all over the premises, chasing cars. I mean, it was a disaster. Now, we had to intervene and get the dog. Here's another poor placement. So my associate said, well, this nursing home has never had an animal in it. The way to start with them is a gerbil. Huh? We'll give them a cage full of gerbils. This guy was hot for gerbils. So I put him in there. It wasn't 24 hours before some of the patients there were down trying to get at those rats so they could stomp on him. You see, they were an agrarian population, you know? That's what you did to rats on the farm. And as far as they were concerned, they were rats. So that was a short human-animal bond. Because of this, my associates, with a little help from me, have developed the guidelines. I have a copy of them here with me that I'll lend to you. I'll probably leave it in the library here. They've exhausted it. They had to reprint it. It's being utilized in many places today, and it has to do with selection and other things. Often they think of dogs and cats only for this, but there's a whole assortment of animals. I stay away from exotics. But on cats, I was going to clear it on one thing. There are devices now. You can change. You can train cats to use the john, and they do this quite well. But I want to caution you about training them to flush, because a cat, they like to flush, and they'll keep flushing. And you'll have to put a timer on the flusher. Okay? Birds are really great for many people. This happens to be a most popular checked out item in the Portland park system. Is that handicapped pigeon? Whenever this handicapped person comes out and plays the piano, the bird gets up and makes up his own dance steps. This fellow watches these fish 4 to 6 hours a day. We know now that that lowers your blood pressure and anxiety level. In fact, my associates who did this study did this in dental offices, compared it with a lovely picture or nothing, and found out that the best effect was watching an aquarium. So more and more now, you'll probably see aquarium in dentist office. This is a very interesting story in Dillon, Montana. And this girl was in uptown Dillon, and she didn't have enough room to raise this lamb for 4-H project, so she went down to the downtown. They had a big nursing home down there and a lot of room. And they said, sure, bring the sheep down here. Well, You can imagine what occupies the nursing home in Dillon, Montana. All sheep herders. She got more about sheep than she'd planned on, I think. They were out there having a great time. There's nothing better for older people than a child and an animal. You can't beat the combination. That's where the nursing homes will all be when I get to be dictator. Be between kindergarten and a farm or the zoo or something. But what happened on this is she had a real great lamb, and a fellow from Australia heard about this, a cattleman, so he bid the highest on it and gave the sheep back to him. And pigs, don't rule out pigs. I had a pet pig, and it's great. They're great. You can teach them to do almost anything. Now, what about therapy? It's my therapist here, left-handed, but very effective. A little of the data, briefly. Here's two of my friends at the University of Pennsylvania. Probably the most famous, there's their aquarium. They were the ones, first ones to show that your blood pressure falls if you watch an aquarium. And Aaron Ketcher on the left, psychiatrist, he and his graduate student and others, in cooperation with the University of Pennsylvania, University of Maryland, did a very interesting study. They followed heart attack victims, serious ones. They had them fill out a very scientific form, a long profile. And somebody convinced them, you ought to add one more question. Do you own a pet or not? Well, they were quite refractive to this because that didn't sound very scientific. But they finally did. Well, what they did, they followed them for a year, these patients, and found out that of all the questions they asked them, nothing really made any difference except one thing. Do you own a pet or not? It turned out that almost a third of those that didn't have a pet were dead at the end of the year, while only 3 out of 53 were dead that had a pet. Well, they're still scratching their heads on this. And there's a lot more to be done about this, but it sure shook up the troops. I have to tell you a little bit about the chief and her dog, which you are all should be introduced to now. I want you to sensitize you to this. We're going to have hearing handicapped people week next week. We don't know how to handle most of the 16 million that are hearing handicapped. I worked with hearing handicapped before my wife. I came home a few days before Easter 3 years ago, and she couldn't hear me anymore. That's a very tragic thing. And so I said, well, we'll get you a hearing dog. She said, no, I can't take another hearing dog. She says, well, can you part with this, and I'll get Kathy to train it. No, she says, so I says, well, we'll train Dingbat. That's what I call this dog. But you better not call her that. You better call her Bridget, okay? Although she prefers Dingbat. But, and you can tell them by their orange collar, orange harness, or yellow-orange leash. And that's a certified animal. She has an ID with her and her dog on it. And Dan helps her answer the phone. I'll be telling more about this on Saturday. But they have, in most states now, the same rights as a guide dog. And here's the trainer that came in for almost 4 or 5 times a week for almost a year to train it, because it was almost 5 years old when I trained it. And it's a lovable creature, and also gives her a lot of comfort. More and more, I'm recommending now two animals in one. Many of you know Gordon Stewart up at Domke. And Gina, you know, I started to tell you about this. He got another dog, but he got two dogs now. And I told him that's a great idea, although he's very old. But for people living alone, when one animal dies, in a survey it was found that most people regard their animal as a member of the family. And when you ask them which member, they say it's a child. And having gone through this, I can tell you how terrible that is. So this is very important that I think the grief is less if you still got an animal remaining, see. Also, if you're living alone and you're gone a lot, the animals are better off having somebody there. In fact, the Spook, that cat that was sitting on the John, he was trouble because she was gone every day. She got in an aquarium with a cover on it. Yeah. And it really settled the cat down. I know another guy that got a turtle for his dog, settled the dog down. Grief, we'll handle that on another time. Grief in animals, there really is a lot of grief in animals, and I'll probably spending most of an hour on this, and we'll talk about that someday. We plan for disasters with people, but not with animals. There's no disaster plan for animals. Probably the only one is in Pullman, Washington, where you don't have a lot of disasters, except a Palouse River flood sometimes. But we have a plan for taking care of the animals, providing food and shelter and housing. I'm also on another push. I'm trying to get all the hospitals to have three more questions on the admissions form. Do you own an animal? Do you live alone? Who should take care of this animal in case of emergency? Because I'm concerned about the animal. And I can give you some real horror stories about it. So what the plea here is, this happened to be Eric Hofer, who was a fellow professor at the University of California when I was there. He made a lot of great statements in his life. He was a philosopher, longshoreman. Never went to formal school, but he's probably read more books than any person in this century, and probably remembered more of it than most. He was a master of a crisp sentence. One of the statements he made, one of the last statements he made, I guess, before he died in written form, was that it may well be that the survival of the species will depend on our ability to foster a boundless capacity for compassion. It is probably our last great hope. And the plea is that we must have more compassion. And this starts with the animals. They are not throwaway items. And that's why I started a course about 4 years ago on reverence for life, which will be another subject that I will be discussing in a few days. Our problem is funding. It's been a problem a long time. The fastest growing population today are those over 65, and the fastest growing of those are over 85. And I'm going to team up with a friend of mine named Maggie Coon. She's a cat lover. She's also the co-founder of the Panthers. And what we're going to do is we're going to get all those people over 65, along with all the pet lovers. It's going to be the strongest legislative advocacy in the world. And we're going to run things. So I'm giving you a fair warning now, that you better be prepared to do it our way, which happens to be the best way. And that's all, folks. It's time for bed. A bear's woke us up. Woke up Rudy and I at 10 minutes after 5.